You're listening to MLB.com Extras, brought to you by MLB.tv. It's baseball everywhere.
Hey everyone, Tim McMaster here, taking you around the National League East for MLB.com Extras. The Mets continue to battle injuries, and now David Wright has opted for surgery on his injured neck. He may miss the rest of the season. So let's start things off with MLB.com's Mets reporter Anthony DiComo. Anthony, the injuries just kind of continue to pile up for this Mets team. Somehow they're kind of getting by and surviving despite it all, but more bad news on Thursday morning as we record this podcast Thursday afternoon, as David Wright has announced, or the Mets have announced, that he will indeed undergo neck surgery. They tried pretty much everything to get him back on the field without the surgery with that neck problem. But in the end, he opts for surgery, could miss 3 months. I would think could miss the rest of the season. How big a blow is this for the Mets right now?
You know, it is and it isn't. And the reason why I say that is it's obviously a monumental blow to the team. Everything that David Wright means to this team, to this franchise, to this organization, and even baseball-wise, still, when he's healthy, he's a big piece for this team. But I think privately the Mets have been bracing for this for a little while now, so I don't think this comes as a huge shock to anyone within the organization. Even coming into this season, you know, if you were the Mets, you very much hoped that you could get a relatively healthy, and by relatively healthy I mean 120, 130 games out of David Wright, but that was far from a sure thing, and I think it was in the back of everyone's mind that David Wright might miss significant time again. Now, it wound up being his neck and not his back. How interrelated those two injuries are, we'll find out. But the Mets did position themselves as well as they could have during the winter to brace for this kind of thing. That's why they went out and got Asdrubal Cabrera, so that they could turn Wilmer Flores into kind of a super sub at every position. Well, now Wilmer Flores is the starter at third base, and he's been playing pretty well in Wright's absence the past couple of weeks. That's not going to preclude the Mets from going out and trying to trade for or acquire in another way a third base replacement, or even someone to pair with Flores, maybe to platoon with Flores, something like that. But for right now, they're okay. They kind of saw this coming. They've been playing without Wright for a while anyways, and while it is a huge blow for this team and for everything David Wright represents, it's something that the Mets have done in the past, and they're going to have to do again, deal with life without David Wright.
And obviously that, like you said, it's become kind of the norm as opposed to the exception. So do the Mets have to start seriously considering just in general a world without David Wright and the thought that he's just not going to be able to play regularly for the rest of his career?
Well, I think at the very least they've reached a point in Wright's career, and let's just assume for the sake of argument that he's gone for the rest of the year. I think that's a pretty safe assumption. Even if he does return, you're talking about minimal returns, minimal production. So going forward, going into next year, he's going to be 34 years old. That's an age where even if he were completely healthy, you would have to start budgeting regular time off for him. You would have to be very careful with how you use him. It's just an age where you can't do things with players that you can do with them in their mid to late 20s, even into their early 30s. Now, when you throw on top of the fact that he's had all these major injuries, and add on top of that that the spinal stenosis condition that we're not even talking about right now is something David Wright is going to have to deal with for the rest of his career, for the rest of his life. I think it's safe to say that if you're the Mets, while you want David Wright back and you want him healthy and you want him productive and you can hope that he can be all of those things for you, you at least have to plan and hedge on the fact that you're probably not going to have a full healthy season from David Wright ever again. It's just a reality at this point. And if there's anyone in baseball who can make it back from all these debilitating injuries that he's undergone, it's right. I mean, this guy still, in his mid-30s, works as hard as anyone, cares as much as anyone, is going to put all the work in and do everything he needs to do to give himself a chance. But yeah, from a baseball operations perspective, from a team planning perspective, how you build this thing, how you shape this thing going forward, I think you do have to operate under the assumption that David Wright's not going to be a regular or at least a consistent part of this.
You mentioned adding a third baseman, and feel free to tell me it's way too soon to speculate, but do any names pop into your mind about guys who maybe are available out there that could come in and help at the hot corner?
Well, the one guy who I think intrigues everyone would be Yulieski Gurriel, the Cuban free agent who MLB just declared a free agent this week. And speaking about him earlier this week, Sandy Alderson said, well, you know, let's see if it fits our need. And that was before David Wright had announced that he was going to undergo surgery. It didn't seem as realistic at the time because there was a thought that David Wright could return, and you're not going to go out and pay big money, maybe spend multiple years on a free agent who, for all intents and purposes, is an everyday third baseman, or at least that's what you would be signing him with the intention of doing if David Wright was going to come back. Well, now David Wright's probably not going to come back, so maybe that becomes a little more realistic. Maybe the Mets decide they want to get in there and start bidding and be one of the high bidders on him. The other reason why he's so intriguing is because if you look at the trade market right now, there's really not a lot out there. There aren't a lot of third baseman who you would consider everyday caliber, who you would consider a clear upgrade over Wilmer Flores, who are playing for teams that don't need their services, teams who can't reasonably expect to be in the pennant chase and don't have an excess or a surplus at that position. So there's not a lot of things the Mets can do. I don't think they're going to go out right now and blow Gurriel away with an offer or anything like that. I think they are very committed, at least in the short term, to Wilmer Flores. They have Kelly Johnson on the roster now, who is a left-handed bat who can fill in there on occasion. Not necessarily a natural third baseman, but he can play the position. So for the short term, they're set, and I think that's one name at least to keep an eye on. And you never know what can happen in the trade market as things develop, as we get deeper into the summer, into July. But there aren't a ton of options there right now, so the Mets' hands are tied a little bit in terms of what they can do.
Pretty cool to be actually doing this in person for a change.
It's great to be here with you, and I enjoy doing these podcasts.
All right, I guess we should start with the news of the day, and that is that Jonathan Papelbon's headed to the disabled list. It was kind of unclear what was wrong with him last night. He obviously didn't pitch Sean Kelly getting the save on Monday night, but then it comes out today that it's a strained intercostal, so he'll go to the DL. Did you get the vibe that it is a 2-week thing, or could he be out longer?
It could be longer, to be honest with you. And the Nationals got to figure out what to do at least for the next month or so. And, you know, right now I think it's going to be a closer by committee. I don't see it just being Sean Kelly, considering they're trying to be careful with his elbow. He has a history of Tommy John. I don't see it being Felipe Rivero either, because he's still young. He's still trying to learn this game. So I think it's going to be bullpen by committee right now.
So Sean Kelly, you would think, get maybe the majority of the things. But is it whoever doesn't close on a particular night, maybe that guy gets the eighth inning?
Yeah. Yes. You know, like some of their guys have been doing very well. For example, Sammy Solis, he's got to get a chance now. He's been dominant. So I wouldn't surprise me if he was given a chance. But, again, this is a wait-and-see thing. I mean, we asked Dusty Baker who's his closer. He said he will not know until game time.
They also made a move, obviously, with Papelbon going to the DL. There's a roster spot there. And it almost comes together at somewhat of a good time because Matt Belisle is now back with the team. And they were getting to the point where they were going to have to make a decision because he was running out of time rehab.
That's correct. And also, too, Dusty Baker loves him. And Dusty Baker says if he can pitch in Colorado, he can pitch anywhere. So Dusty Baker's happy to have him back. I think he'll be one of the guys who will be pitching the eighth inning, but again, with Dusty Baker, you never know.
This is obviously a big series, and especially the way it went in Chicago, because the Cubs obviously swept that series from the Nationals. These are two teams that expect to be playing in October. Monday night, Max Scherzer kind of leads the way, and he got beat up a little bit in Chicago. What was the difference on Monday night where he allows just the two hits, strikes out 11?
Well, he got a lot of strike ones, and his slider was really working this time. And I think the ballpark makes a difference, too. I mean, you pitch in Wrigley Field, which is a friendly hitter's ballpark compared to Nationals Park, which is, you know, even out for everybody. So I think that was the difference there, and it's great to see him really carry this team the way he does.
they need kind of the same improvement, I guess, against this Cubs team from Gio Gonzalez on Tuesday night. And Gio really in a funk lately, lost four straight starts. I guess for him it's control command also.
Yes, it is. But, you know, his last start, he had one bad inning, and it wasn't that bad if he didn't have that one bad inning. But, yes, you're right. He can't walk many people. He's had an 8 ERA during his four-game losing streak, and he's got to help this team big time.
The big storyline from that series at Wrigley was all the walks of Bryce Harper. I think it ended up being 13 walks in the series, and he had started struggling kind of the series before that against the Phillies, but since then he seems to not quite be in sync, the timing off, or whatever it is. They did pitch to him on Monday night, 1-for-5. He has the single, which led to a run, no RBI. Do you think he sees pitches throughout this series, or is it going to be a night tonight?
I think he's going to see pitches only because Dusty Baker had to change his lineup because of that Cubs series. And as you know, Daniel Murphy is hitting cleanup now. So I think he will see, Bryce Harper will see a lot of pitches. But I think they're going to be careful with him like all the teams have done lately. But I think he will get out of this funk and he will become the Bryce Harper we're used to.
Even without him being that Bryce Harper, this team offensively has suddenly been much better. Over the last this streak they're on where they've won 7 out of 8 games right now. They're averaging over 7 runs a game in that stretch. Some other guys that have stepped up big time. We got to talk about Wilson Ramos. I don't know if we've talked much about Wilson Ramos in this podcast all season, but he's been good all year. He's been even better lately.
He's been great. I mean, the defense has always been there. But the hitting, I guess, you know, the LASIK surgery has been the difference. And we see him go the other way, something he didn't do last year. And he's hitting all over the place. And I think this is going to be the first time he's going to be an All-Star. There's no doubt in my mind about that.
Yeah, last 13 games, 386 clip, 15 RBIs in that stretch. So he's been great. And then out of the blue, here comes Danny Espinosa. It's kind of funny the way this has worked out, but Trey Turner comes up for a weekend, has one great game, and since then, I'm sure more coincidence than anything, Espinosa's been better in the batter's box. Have you noticed anything different? I mean, he's had the power all year, and that's continued, but the average, he's been getting on base more.
Well, first of all, Tim, I owe Danny Espinosa an apology because I told you I thought Trey Turner should be the shortstop right now. And the difference we've seen with Danny Espinosa is that he's going the other way, especially from the left side, and he's using the entire ballpark now. He shortened up his swing. I think his base hit on Sunday against the Phillies was the big difference. That's the reason they won the game. And I owe him an apology, and I don't know what to say. That's the way I feel.
Maybe he heard you and motivated him.
Maybe.
Anyway, over the stretch, latest stretch for Espinosa, 10 for 23, 3 homers, 5 RBIs, a couple doubles mixed in there. He's raised his average over basically a week from 196 to 223, which isn't easy at this point in the season. And his batting average on balls in play has leaped. It was 220 for most of the year. Over the last week, he's hitting 467 as far as the BABIP goes. So maybe some bad luck early has turned into really good luck as of lately, but he's certainly playing better at the plate, and the defense is obviously always there. One other player on this team I wanted to touch on, just because he's kind of putting himself in the record books historically, people have different opinions on what a win means these days, but Steven Strasburg, 10-0, it's hard to really say anything negative about that.
No, I mean, the guy is still one of the top pitchers in baseball. I mean, but he's humble about it, and he's quiet, and, you know, he's not going to be rah-rah about it. I just think this is going to be another all-star year for him. And I'll tell you this, though. I think as the months go by, I think he's going to be the best pitcher on this team this year because he seems so relaxed this time. I mean, compared to other years, he seems like nothing bothers him now, and that's the way I like to see from him.
Phillies have become what we thought they were, I think. It's getting tough, and these podcasts, obviously, have gotten to the point where we're going to try not to dwell too much on what's going on the field, but the Phillies last won a series, I was looking it up today, May 16th to the 18th, so basically a month ago. They did beat the Blue Jays on Monday night, but then they fall on Tuesday and also on Wednesday. One good takeaway, though, I guess, from Wednesday's game is that Cody Ashe had a nice night. 3-for-4, a homer, 2 doubles. He had been so cold coming in, and obviously he's been cold basically since he got healthy and back on this roster. How key is it for him to swing somewhat of a hot bat in this lineup?
For Cody Ashby personally, it's huge for him. You know, I had a real good talk with him in spring training and talking about his kind of where he stands in the organization. You know, a couple of years ago, they had real high hopes for him. They didn't think he was going to be a perennial all-star or anything like that, but they thought he would be a real solid contributor in this Phillies lineup, you know, kind of a piece of the puzzle going forward. And he really never took that next step forward, and he's kind of been the same type of player. So he entered this season knowing that he needed to play really well to be a part of this team's future, if not as an everyday player, an everyday outfielder, as maybe as like a key guy off the bench. You can certainly make a nice career doing that. So to come into last night's game, in the Wednesday night's game, hitting 200, really not doing much of anything, certainly did not bode well for him. But Wednesday night, he has the home run. He has a couple of doubles. Maybe this gets him started. And again, I don't think anybody at the Phillies right now is going, you know, we got to find out if Cody Ashby's our next everyday outfielder. They just want to know, you know, is he worth holding on to down the road? You know, is he worth keeping on this 25-man roster or 40-man roster? Is he worth, you know, maybe making him as a left fielder slash first baseman slash third baseman, kind of a super utility type of guy? And, you know, for his sake, I think he hopes that last Wednesday night was a step in the right direction.
You continue to get these little glimpses from this young rotation. And Monday night in Toronto, which is a tough place to pitch, not just the ballpark, but obviously the lineup as well. And Jared Eichhoff goes out 6 shutout innings. That's an impressive performance as a guy kind of continues to grow.
Yeah, you know, Jared Eichhoff, they love the guy. They really do. They don't know exactly how good he's going to be or what he's going to become, but they really are pulling for him hard. You know, they think he's got a lot of potential, and they certainly think he can be better than, you know, what he was billed as coming aboard from Texas last July, which was, you know, he could be a pretty solid number four, number five-ish type of starter. I think they're hoping that he could be a solid number three type of guy, you know, a workhorse, a bulldog. You know, the coaching staff fell in love with him last year. His teammates fell in love with him last year because he really attacked the strike zone. He didn't screw around on the mound. He got the ball. He threw it, and he's pitched with success. So very encouraging start for him. Like you said, I've covered many Phillies Blue Jays games over the last several years, and it does not matter who the pitcher is. It seems like the Phillies pitchers are getting hit and hit hard. I remember Cliff Lee a few years ago. He was cruising through six scoreless innings. He had a nice shutout streak going. Seventh inning, he got absolutely lit up, knocked out of the game, and the Phillies lost the game. So, you know, to pitch well, to pitch with success up there, I think is a heck of an accomplishment for Jared Eichhoff.
Now, on the other side of things, we saw the major league debut of Zach Eflin, and, well, it didn't go the way you'd like, but sometimes major league debuts tend to kind of go that way. We've seen it with one of the best prospects in the game this year, Julio Urias, really struggled in his first outing. But Zach Eflin had been pitching really well down Lehigh Valley, 5-2, the ERA under 3. He's super young, 22 years old. He was a first-round pick of the Padres back in 2012. Comes up, and he took it on the chin a little bit. 2 2/3 innings, 8 earned runs. I know he took it as best he could. He said he had to put it behind him. Is that a performance, though, that could stick with him a little bit?
Well, certainly they're hoping not. You know, and not that you can make this comparison, really, but right before the season started, he pitched in an exhibition game in Reading. And it was basically Phillies' kind of quote-unquote stars of tomorrow versus what it was expected to be the Phillies' opening day roster. And he got absolutely lit up there. And a lot of people asked that same question. They said, boy, do you think this could impact him negatively? Do you think he could let this carry with him? Like, oh my gosh, I just got crushed by a bunch of, you know, by the Phillies, you know. But it didn't. He bounced back. He realized it was only one start, and he handled it quite well. So I think that's what the Phillies are hoping here too, is that he bounces back from this. I thought he had a great attitude about it. He said, listen, you know, obviously I wish I could have pitched better, but I got to live out my dream of pitching in the major leagues. It was a good experience in the sense that, you know, I'm up here. I got a taste of it, and now he's kind of hoping to take that next step forward and brush it off. But like I just mentioned about Jared Eichhoff, and it is so tough to pitch up there. And to be honest, Tim, I said last week when Vince Velasquez got hurt, I said, oh, man, Are they going to have Mathlin make his big league debut in Toronto? That is a really, really tough pull in terms of making major league debuts. But he did. He got knocked around, and certainly he's going to get a few more starts to prove that he can put it past him.
Yeah, you mentioned the reason he's up, and that's Velasquez being injured. Franco also injured. Any updates on those guys? What's the timetable as far as Velasquez and Franco?
Well, Velasquez, they are absolutely not going to rush, which makes I am in total agreement with. There's no reason to rush him. You see the Phillies coming back to earth record-wise. He's a huge part of this team's future. He's got an injury history. There's durability concerns about him. It's a bicep injury. They don't think it's serious. But really, why rush him back right now? You know, the team is not going to be a postseason team. Take him along slowly. Bring him along real slowly. And then when he's really, truly ready, put him back in the rotation. But they were going to watch his innings count this season anyway because he had never pitched more than 124 innings in a season. So they're not going to rush him back. Michael Franco is expected to be back in the lineup Thursday night. He sprained his knee Sunday in D.C. He has not started since. He pinch hit on Wednesday night, struck out on three pitches. But they're hoping that he can kind of pick up where he left off. You know, he had not actually hit the ball that well the first 2 months of the season. He'd been pretty ordinary, quite frankly. And then in June, he had started heat up. He's hit about 270 this month with, I think, three or four home runs, an OPS of about 830, 840. Those are good numbers for him, and that's what they need for him. So they're hoping, I guess, that he didn't start to heat up, tweak his knee, and then he's got to start from scratch.
Joe, you look at this Marlins team right now, finishing off a long West Coast trip, a nine-game trip through the western part of the country. So far right now, 4-4 going into Wednesday's game. So a chance to come out of this with a winning record, which is good. Obviously, helped by finishing things off with the Padres, a team that's certainly struggling. But they get a big lift on Tuesday night from Jeff Mathis. Obviously, Mathis, a guy that's a catcher that's there for his catching skills and not for his bat. And I know Don Mattingly's been trying to get him in there against lefties. He did a chance to do that. Comes through with a big grand slam and a five-run first, and that's all the runs the Marlins got. But it's always nice to get a lift from your backup catcher.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Tim, you know, Jeff Mathis, he's one of those guys that's the batting average, the career batting average is under 200. Clearly not an offensive player, but, you know, definitely one of the most popular and favorite players on the team. Adds so much value in his ability to handle pitchers, play defense, his leadership, his mentorship to JT Realmuto, who's having a really good season and a promising player as well. So for Mathis to contribute with the bat was huge for him. Obviously, he's not going to be doing that, you know, very often. But Mattingly did note that he'd like to try to match him up with lefties a little bit more because he hits a little bit better against them. Just so happened the last two starts he had, going back to a start in Arizona even last Friday against Patrick Corbin, the lefty, he drew a walk in the seventh inning that helped set up Justin Bour's grand slam. So any contributions at the plate are a huge lift. But I think what we're seeing, you know, kind of on a bigger picture that we've seen start to emerge on this road trip is the penchant for the big inning. You know, the Marlins have kind of, you know, they get a lot of hits, but they don't do a ton with runners in scoring position or driving in runs. They're not a big home run hitting team, but they, you know, they had two innings with seven, in Minnesota and carried over into Arizona, and then a five run inning in the first on game two of the series in San Diego. So they are starting to show signs of the ability to break a game open or at least get back into a game by scoring in bunches in innings.
Yeah, you mentioned them not being a big home run hitting team, and even less so when Giancarlo Stanton continues to struggle the way he has. And now he's been out of the lineup a decent amount lately. I know he has said enough talk, I just need to get things turned around on the field. But what's going on as far as him getting the rest and everything?
Yeah, it's, you know, they seem to say physically, he's fine or getting as fine as can be from that right side issue. Again, we don't know exactly what that was, whether it was a rib or intercostal or an oblique type thing. But, you know, he played against the lefty on game two here in San Diego, and then he sits against a right-hander in favor of Itro. Even on the day he had a double and scorched the ball 116 miles an hour, which is
always a great sign to see. But one thing I've heard is he's kind of Stan's kind of trying to get out of this alone. He's not, you know, he's kind of putting everyone at arm's length, and you know, including the coaching staff, and he's, you know, I guess he's heard from so many different people, so many ways to get out of the slump that he's kind of wanting to do it himself. And I don't know whether that has anything to do with, you know, Mattingly going with Ichiro a little bit more, but obviously Ichiro has been hitting like crazy and is completely adding a spark. So might be combination of ride the hot hand with Ichiro and, you know, allow Stanton to do it his own way.
I guess there's something about hearing too many voices and it all kind of getting cloudy and confusing. So I think you need to be able to focus in on maybe one person that you trust. And you would hope with the Marlins that would be
you would think,
a guy like Barry Bonds.
I'll give you a quick story.
Right?
Back in 2005, Mike Lowell's last year with the Marlins, he had a miserable year at the plate. He had, I think, 8 home runs that whole year. And here Lowell at the time had been a multiple All-Star, a Silver Slugger. You know, he was a very accomplished player with Miami then, and he got off to a slow start, and everybody was telling him what to do, and he seen he had a bad year, and then he kind of, after that year, he kind of acknowledges that one guy would say this, and he would work on that, and it wouldn't work, and then someone had something else, and he just kind of went back to being himself, and he obviously resurfaced in Boston a couple of years later and was a World Series MVP. So, you know, sometimes hearing too many voices or not really trusting, you know, or maybe even, you know, with Stanton, knowing him well, he kind of puts a lot in himself. So he may be trying to do things internally to just try to get out of it. But clearly, you know, he's the one in the batter's box. He's the one that's got to make the adjustments. But one thing that has been pointed out to me and probably obvious to people who watch him a lot is how far away he is from the plate and, you know, how often he's beat on the outside portion of it. So whether he feels he could cover that portion of the plate, you know, being where he feels comfortable or making the adjustment, that's to be seen.
Does being off the plate, that brings up a question just right in my head, is there anything to do with him being hit in the head? I mean, is that why
no.
he's off the plate?
And
is there a little nerve there?
That was now 2 years ago. And, you know, keep in mind, he had, 20-something homers, 26, 27 homers last year and got hurt in late June. And you know, he was doing it a year, less than a year after the injury. So he could say, but, you know, he has worn that face guard against right-handed pitching and not against lefties. And now he's starting to take it off against certain righties. And I've asked him about it in the past. There's never a definitive answer. Obviously, you would think a Syndergaard is going 99. It closes one up and in, you may want to wear it. But, you know, guys like Ricky Nolasco, who in Minnesota is a good friend, he didn't wear it and got a couple of hits off him. But you know, I think he was pretty confident Ricky wasn't going to run him up and in. So I think it's a feel thing with Stanton, and just, you know, he sometimes doesn't overthink and sometimes he does overthink. So there's a lot of mystery going on here, Tim.
Mark, the Braves have dropped the first two games of the series at home to the Reds, and those are the kind of games that I don't think the Braves can afford to lose in a season where they're clearly, you know, outmanned for the most part. The Reds are a team in a similar situation. You get them at home, you'd like to take advantage of that opportunity. But it's a four-game series, so a couple more to try to get things turned around. They've done some things here this week. One move, Malik Smith moving to the top of the order. Something he did when Ender Inciarte was injured earlier in the season, but now Inciarte's healthy. What's the goal with Smith hitting leadoff? Is this just a chance to see if he can kind of do it?
Yeah, that's exactly what they want to do. You know, as early as probably around this time last year and a little bit earlier, they started to say, hey, look, Malik Smith is the leadoff hitter of the future. They moved Jose Peraza out of the leadoff spot for that reason, down there at the minor league level. They went and got Inciarte and immediately touted him as their leadoff hitter of the future. And now here they are back to – it does make sense. So I do think that Malik, you have to give him a chance in this role, see how he performs. I think he does profile more as a leadoff hitter than Inciarte, who's been a little bit – I'd say he's a little bit more aggressive, you know, type of hitter than you make one at there at the leadoff spot, chases some bad pitches. And, hey, look, at this stage of the career, Malik Smith is still doing the same. But I think they just are saying, hey, look, this is a prime opportunity to give him a chance to perform in this role. you know, and continue, whether they sat him against a lot of lefties. They allowed him to hit in that leadoff spot there against Brandon Finnegan, a pretty tough lefty there, the Red Southpaw there Tuesday night. But at the same time, I think they'll pick and choose some spots here moving forward. But as things stand, and as we know with the Braves, the plans change quite frequently. The plan is to move forward, using Smith in the leadoff spot and Enciarte batting second.
We're going to get into the draft a little bit later in the podcast here, and obviously there's been a big focus in general on young pitchers for the Braves. But Mark, over the last couple weeks or last few starts, a couple of the veterans have looked pretty good. I put Julio Teheran into that veteran category for the team right now. And then Bud Norris as well. Last two starts after returning to the rotation, faced the Dodgers June 4th, faced the Cubs, which is obviously an impressive lineup, June 10th. And he very good. I'm 5 innings, 3 hits, a run against the Dodgers, but then 7 innings and an earned run against the Cubs. Solid outings for Norris, and this is the kind of stuff they thought they were getting coming into the season from Norris, I think, right?
Well, you know, this is what is more than they probably had hoped for, considering the circumstances. You know, he gets moved out of the rotation there with at the end of April. He spends a month in the bullpen. Doesn't, you know, really had two appearances where he threw more than 30 pitches over the course of that month. Goes out to L.A. and provides 5 solid innings. Comes back 5 days later, 5 more solid innings against the Cubs lineup. You know, I think this is a credit to Bud Norris's character. I mean, he certainly didn't appreciate being moved out of the rotation, which is expected. But at the same time, he didn't pout. He was relatively effective in the bullpen, you know, filling a lot of different roles, long man, middle man, setup man. You know, he's been bounced around. He gets put back in the rotation, he says, you know, and he's got a little chip on his shoulder. He's a guy who he has a lot of confidence on in himself, and for good reason, you know, based on what he's shown here as he's come back and proved his doubters wrong. It's you know, moving forward, the Braves hope to continue to get these kind of starts from him, and you know, this is the middle of June, so by this time next month, if he's still doing the same, we'll be talking about, you know, where they might trade him, because that's certainly the spot he's in right now. They're hoping to gain some value from him, but you know, like you said, when they signed him, they were hoping, hey, we'll get a couple months out and trade him, bring up some of the young kids. You know, that ended up that those plans changed there when he was struggled so frequently through his 5 April starts, but now they may be able to get back to within the next month or so, be able to get some value from him.
Yeah, work that flip game with him. So John Gant gets a start on Sunday, and I know he didn't last 5 innings, Mark, but what did you think of Gant in a starting role?
You know what? It's interesting. A lot of scouts coming out of spring training said, hey, look, he's a reliever, and he probably is. But he has been much more effective as a starter, you know, at Gwinnett, than he was as a reliever here in Atlanta. I know that's, you know, that comparison can be apples and oranges, but at the same time, I think it's interesting how effective he was on Sunday against the Cubs. He issued a few early walks, pitched, you know, got better as the start went on. He's basically a fastball changeup guy with a very deceptive delivery. Maybe it is just simply going to take some time for teams to get used to getting a look at that a few times. But, hey, look, with Mike Fulton, Evie Turk, Williams Perez hurt, it makes sense to give Gant a few starts. I thought that they might have gone with Casey Kelly and given him a few more starts, because I thought Casey deserved it after what he did in Philadelphia. But at the same time, I think if you're looking at, hey, look, which upside do we not know about yet as a starter? I think that you're probably pointing towards John Gant. So it probably makes more sense to put him in this role, give him a few starts at least until Foltynewicz or Perez return. Foltynewicz should be first to return among those two. And just see what you have.